Tylenol murders of 1982, in which cyanide-tainted medication killed 7 people in Chicago, give us a noteworthy example of the interactions between crime, forensic science, and society. That incident gave rise to significant changes in product packaging, resulting in the types of tamper-proof containers we've become accustomed to today. Federal anti-tampering laws, enacted in 1983 and 84, made crimes like that a federal offense. Stores increasingly began to install surveillance cameras. In addition, insurance companies started offering manufacturers protection against tampering, whether intended or accidental, to cover the cost of product recalls or related lawsuits if an incident occurred. The second phenomenon the Tylenol murders prompted was a rash of copycat attacks, as well as related hoaxes. The last death in the Tylenol series occurred on October 1st, and within the 4 weeks following, 270 cases of suspected product tampering were reported to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, known as the FDA. Some of the incidents were thought to be a form of mass hysteria, in which anybody who felt sick after eating or drinking anything wondered about having been poisoned. But the FDA was able to substantiate that 36 of those 270 cases were legitimate acts of small-scale terrorism in which a product had been altered. For instance, at the end of that October, several Halloween trick-or-treaters discovered pins and needles in candy items in areas as diverse as New York, Connecticut, Florida, and Chicago. In Detroit, razor blades and nails were found in packages of hot dogs. A Minneapolis 14-year-old was sickened by chocolate milk tainted with lye. And a 27-year-old Florida police officer drank insecticide-poisoned orange juice and began vomiting immediately. Luckily, both of them recovered. In 1986, a copycat named Stella Nickel of the Seattle area used the Tylenol case as inspiration to kill her husband, Bruce. First, she bought a bunch of life insurance on him, and then decided to commit additional tamperings to disguise him as her intended target. Nickel put cyanide into packages of both extra-strength Excedrin and Anacin 3. And as a result, not only did her husband die, but 6 days later, so did Susan Snow, who picked up one of Nickel's deadly packages at a local store. The cyanide was discovered at Snow's autopsy, linked to the product found at her home, and then the media released an alert. Amazingly, Nickel herself came forward to claim that her husband, whose cause of death had been ruled emphysema, had taken Excedrin of the same lot number publicized by the media after Snow's death. Bruce Nickel had already been buried, but since he was a registered organ donor, the hospital still had a sample of his blood. Toxicology results revealed cyanide, and luckily, no one received any of his donor tissues. Stella Nickel, along with Snow's husband, instigated wrongful death lawsuits against Bristol-Myers, the company that manufactured Excedrin. An FBI investigation found cyanide in the 2 packages Nickel turned in and the bottle from Snow's home, and 2 other tainted products discovered on store shelves. But in those 5 packages, investigators also found mysterious green flecks. They determined these were from an algicide commonly used in fish tanks. The FBI's chemical analysis even named the specific brand, a compound marketed as Algae Destroyer. Now, agents knew from a visit to her home that Nickel had an aquarium and figured she could have used the algicide container to crush the cyanide crystals in. So the next thing they did was canvass local pet stores using a photo array that included Nickel's picture. One clerk identified Nickel's image, saying the woman stood out because she had a bell jingling from her purse. The clerk said the lady was a regular purchaser of fish supplies, including the type of algicide found in the tainted capsules. Now, the FBI's suspicions grew even greater after Nickel told agents she bought the 2 tainted packages on 2 different occasions and from 2 different stores. Now, the odds of her picking up 2 of only 5 poisoned bottles discovered just seemed incredibly unlikely. At an FBI interview where Nickel refused a polygraph, the agent noticed a bell dangling from her purse. Now, digging further into Nichols' background, they discovered the recent insurance policies, and FBI handwriting experts discovered that Bruce Nichols' signatures on them had been forged. The real break in the case came in early 1987, when Nichols' daughter from a prior relationship told police that her mother had spoken about wanting to kill her current husband. The daughter knew Nichols had even researched poisoning methods at the public library. Agents went to the local library and asked about a patron named Stella Nichols. Librarians showed them an overdue notice from a book Nichols never returned. Its title, Human Poisoning. She'd also checked out other books on the subject, and in them, the FBI agents found no less than 84 of Nichols' fingerprints, most on pages related to cyanide, including in a book titled Deadly Harvest and the C volumes from several of the library encyclopedias. But why did Stella come forward if all she really wanted was to get rid of her husband? Well, the insurance carried on Bruce Nichols paid an additional $100,000 if his death was ruled an accident. Investigators learned that Nichols had questioned her husband's doctors in the week following his death about their ruling he died from emphysema. Plus, she had the chance of cashing in on the lawsuit against Bristol Myers. But Nichols was sloppy. At trial, the tainted packages were described with seals clearly cut and obvious regluing on the boxes. Sadly, that was not enough to dissuade Susan Snow, the other casualty, from taking the medication. Nichols was sentenced to 90 years in prison in the first case prosecuted under the new federal laws prompted by the Tylenol murders. Now, if there can be a lighter note to product tampering, this is it. In 2010, a Long Island couple, 68-year-old Alexander Clement and his wife Christine, who was 64, they were charged with petty larceny and product tampering. Their target was Jell-O brand pudding mix. Alexander drove Christine to four different stores where she bought 10 boxes of the pudding mix each time. Their favorites were apparently pistachio and butterscotch. The couple brought the packages home, presumably ate the pudding, and then filled plastic sandwich bags with aquarium sand and salt, put them in the Jell-O boxes, resealed the packages, and returned them to the stores for the $1.40 refund. The fraud came to light when other customers bought the tampered packages and complained to the stores. Surveillance tapes from security cameras identified the Clements. They were charged, but police say they didn't really think the couple meant any real harm. They were very apologetic, and Christine suffered from what they called an age-related mental issue. Now, technically, there's a difference between fraud and what's considered a hoax. Fraud nets the perpetrator some type of financial or personal gain, whether by harming somebody else or not. A hoax is something that is humorous, malicious, or maybe both, but not intended to gain any real benefit to the person who originates it. Let's look at an example. In 1990, an Ontario, Canada grocery store clerk found a hypodermic syringe in a sealed Pepsi bottle. Although authorities never got to the bottom of it, they eventually assumed the likely source was a disgruntled employee from the bottling company. But 3 years later, in June of 1993, in the span of just a couple days, reports of hypodermic needles being found in Pepsi cans cropped up around the United States in what was a media frenzy. The first report came in from an 82-year-old man in Tacoma, Washington, who said he poured himself a Pepsi one day and then the next day retrieved the can because of a contest he heard the soft drink company was running. Inside the can, the man saw a syringe with its needle bent. So he contacted his attorney, who reported the incident to the police. The story quickly found its way to the media, and within the next week or so, over 60 reports of hypodermic needles being found in Pepsi cans spanned 24 states. The story was headline news. Products included Pepsi, Diet Pepsi, caffeine-free Diet Pepsi. In addition to hypodermic syringes, also reported were screws, a sewing needle, a bullet, and a crack cocaine vial. Now, Pepsi brought in the media on their end to demonstrate how unlikely it was these reports were true. Their automated plants produced 2,000 cans a minute, each one open for just 0.9 of a second. At that rate, tampering was literally impossible. They refused to issue a recall. Eventually, it was determined that not one of the claims was true. The allegations were just a vicious copycat cycle in which more and more gold diggers and attention seekers jumped on the tampering bandwagon to discredit Pepsi or get their 5 minutes of fame. The FBI arrested at least 20 people who had planted foreign objects in soft drink containers. Now, at that point, to try to stop the madness, Pepsi's CEO went on NBC's Nightline with the head of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They emphasized the penalty for fraudulent product tampering claims was 5 years in prison and $250,000 fine, adding they would continue to seek out and prosecute hoaxers. Now, people started coming forward to admit false claims because they didn't want to be prosecuted. Shortly after that, Pepsi placed full-page ads and discount coupons in national newspapers, thanking the American public for believing in their product. But between that hoax and the cashed-in coupons, the incident cost Pepsi an estimated $35 million. All in all, 53 people were arrested in the nationwide hoax. Even the elderly man who first reported the incident was discredited after authorities discovered one of his relatives injected insulin and probably had placed the syringe in the can to protect others. That's a practice recommended by the American Diabetes Association. Also, the can the man had brought to his attorney was a Diet Pepsi, while the 24-pack he claimed it came from was a regular Pepsi. Perhaps he had just gotten confused and picked up an empty can he thought was from the day before, but really had grabbed one his diabetic relative placed a syringe in, say, the last time she visited. A major thread of forensic evidence throughout the case was that investigators could find no correlation among the allegedly contaminated cans. They came from multiple plants around the U.S., and some cans had been filled days prior to being reported, others weeks before, while others were months after they left the plant. One source stated the saddest part of this story is that many people remember the needles in Pepsi cans as fact, rather than as a nationwide scam intended to sabotage a major soft drink manufacturer. So hopefully we've dispelled that in telling this tale. Now, as an anthropologist, I have to say that one of my favorite false claims, if one may have a favorite, is the story of Piltdown Man, one of the most famous scientific hoaxes, or some might say frauds, in all of history. In 1912, an amateur archaeologist named Charles Dawson reported on 5 thick skull fragments of what appeared to be a primitive hominid discovered in the Piltdown Quarry in Sussex, England. Dawson was affiliated with the British Museum and was delighted with the find, particularly since it showed that a cradle of humanity was in England. The specimen was given the scientific name Eoanthropus, which translates to the dawn of man, followed by Dawson's self-tribute, Dawsoni. Eoanthropus Dawsoni showed both human and ape characteristics and was quickly touted as the big missing link scientists had been searching for nearly half a century. Neanderthals had been discovered as early as 1856 in the Neander Valley of Germany, just 3 years before Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species in England. By the late 1860s, Cro-Magnons had been found in France, and in 1871, Darwin published The Descent of Man. But after that, the fossil focus shifted to Asia, where Java Man was discovered in 1891, then back to Germany for Heidelberg Man in 1907. As tensions between Britain and Germany increased in the prelude to World War I, perhaps Dawson just grew tired of there being no great hominid fossil finds in England. There were 2 main Piltdown discoveries, one at Piltdown in 1912 and a second cache in 1915, allegedly found some 2 miles from the quarry at an undisclosed location. Between those 2 finds, Dawson brought the British Museum 2 partial skulls, half a lower jaw with molar teeth in it, and 1 canine tooth that fit the jaw, all attributed to his Eoanthropus Dawsoni. Plus, he had a tool made of carved elephant bone, fossil teeth from a number of other animals from the Pleistocene epoch, which lasted from about 1.5 million to 10,000 years ago. From the start, both American and French paleontologists criticized the Piltdown find, saying the first skull and its supposedly related jawbone could not possibly be from the same individual. But objections quieted down a bit after papers were published about the second skull in 1917, and Piltdown man took his place in fossil history. Some scientists simply chose to ignore the Piltdown fossils as an aberration. In fact, physical anthropologist Sherwood Washburn stated, quote, "I remember writing a paper on human evolution in 1944, and I simply left Piltdown out. You could make sense of human evolution if you didn't try to put Piltdown into it," unquote. It wasn't until 1953, over 40 years since the initial discovery, that the scientific community finally learned that Piltdown man was not only an incredible contribution to paleontology, it was a complete hoax. Already existing cracks in the Piltdown story were significantly weakened in 1949, when the specimens were analyzed by British physical anthropologist and paleontologist Kenneth Oakley. He was one of the pioneers of dating fossils using fluorine content. Now, Oakley determined that Piltdown skulls 1 and 2 were both from modern humans of the medieval period, likely about 620 years old. The jaw that many scientists said did not belong with the skull was about 500 years old and from a Borneo orangutan. The canine was from a Pleistocene chimpanzee, the elephant fossils likely from Tunisia, and the fossil hippo tooth was probably from Malta or Sicily. Later testing showed that Dawson, or someone else, used a weak acid solution to remove some of the mineral content from the skull fragments, and then applied some kind of a stain containing iron to age them, as well as the jawbone, to make the specimens look consistent with fossils discovered in gravel, where iron's common. The molars from the orangutan jaw had been filed down flat to appear more human-like, and the joint surfaces where the jaw would fit into the skull were broken off before the staining, so it wouldn't be so obvious that the jaw didn't anatomically fit the skull. Microscopic examination showed the canine tooth was also filed down and actually covered with brown paint. A piece of the tooth that had been broken was attached with, are you ready for this, chewing gum covered over with sand. To this day, no one knows for sure who actually tainted and planted the specimens, whether it was Dawson alone, him in collaboration with others, or he was handed the finds, maybe even for money, and simply just took credit for them. It's been suggested, though, that despite the two main discoveries being a couple years apart, the doctoring of the evidence was done at the same time, after which the quarry had either been salted with the specimens on a single occasion, taking a real chance that the alleged fossils would ever be found, or that Dawson returned to the quarry several times to plant and then allegedly discover them. The thing is, though, other than the jawbone which Dawson himself dug up, anonymous workers at the quarry actually made the discoveries, but maybe in exchange for payment from Dawson or others. In any event, the perpetrator had to have a certain amount of paleontological and anatomical know-how to pull this scam off, and Dawson was just an amateur. That's why some sources suspect he may have been a pawn in a bigger game created by others. Dawson was famous, though, for his amazing discoveries in the world of antiquities and fossils. He was known locally as the Wizard of Sussex. It's since come to light that some of those finds were other hoaxes of his day. In 2003, Bournemouth University analyzed some of Dawson's famous antiquities and found at least 30 of them were fakes. Interestingly, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, of Sherlock Holmes fame, he's also been suggested as having been involved or even been the main perpetrator. He was an amateur bone hunter in his day. He was also a neighbor of Dawson's, and he actually dug at Piltdown with him. Doyle was an avowed spiritualist, and some authors have suggested he promulgated that Piltdown hoax to get back at science for its attack on psychics and other aspects of his beliefs. It's been argued that Doyle's 1912 work, The Lost World, published the same year as the first Piltdown discovery, provides a veiled literary account of the hoax. Others argue there's no way he could have planted the bones and realistically expected them to be found, by either Dawson or the quarry workers. Another theory suggests the perpetrator was a zoologist named Martin Hinton, who worked at the British Museum at the time. In the 1970s, workers found an old dusty trunk with his initials on it in the museum's loft. Inside the trunk, they found teeth and bones that were stained the same way as those from the Piltdown hoax. They also found stained pieces of both elephant and hippo fossil teeth that looked as though they came right out of the Piltdown quarry with the others of their exact same species. Scientific analysis demonstrated the staining methods on the items in Hinton's trunk matched those in the Piltdown case. However, in 1899, years before the Piltdown discoveries, Hinton had published a paper about nature's effects on bones and teeth when they fossilize in gravel. So, is it possible that the specimens in Hinton's trunk were created in the lab, maybe to try and duplicate the natural processes he was seeing in the field? If so, could Dawson have used some of them to salt the quarry? In addition, Hinton had done work for Oakley, the scientist who exposed the Piltdown fraud using the fluorine dating. So could Hinton have been trying to replicate the hoax in the lab, maybe to help Oakley discredit the Piltdown hoax? None of that seems likely, since Hinton died in 1961, years after the hoax was revealed, yet never said a word about any confirmatory studies he had done to try to expose the fraud, or any other lab experiments related to staining bones or teeth. Another problem with Hinton as a suspect is he really didn't have the access to the Piltdown site that others from the British Museum had. So if it was Hinton, he had to have an accomplice in the field. Another theory is that someone else planted a handful of the never-used Piltdown fakes in Hinton's storage at the museum. Otherwise, if Hinton had made the decoys, why wouldn't he have destroyed any possible evidence after the hoax was revealed? As for Dawson, he died of blood poisoning at the age of 52, just a year after the second Piltdown skull fragments were discovered. Fortunately, no one has said anything suspicious about Dawson's death. I mean, it's one thing to fake a man, it's another thing to kill one. The last prime contender worthy of mention in this case is Arthur Smith Woodward, the head of the British Museum's Natural History Department at the time. Woodward, who was then vying for the position of museum director, would have benefited greatly from the Piltdown discovery. He was the only person who had consistent and unlimited access to all the Piltdown specimens, and the one who, following Dawson's death, reported the second skull as having been discovered by Dawson a year earlier. Also suspicious is that Woodward was highly reluctant to allow any real scientific testing on the materials discovered. He essentially kept the original specimens locked up for nearly 40 years and provided access to very few researchers, preferring they work with plaster casts instead. Some say Woodward was just incompetent, not really malicious, since he did return to Piltdown year after year to continue the search. It's hard to imagine how on earth those makeshift fossils weren't exposed long before they were. Some say both British nationalism and cultural racism influenced people to believe in Piltdown Man's authenticity. Europeans and some Americans wanted to cling to the theory that Europe was the cradle of mankind, despite concurrent finds of true hominids being made in Asia and Africa. In 2012, the 100th anniversary of the Piltdown discovery, scientists made new attempts to conduct sophisticated testing on the specimens. DNA has been difficult to extract, though, likely due to the acid used on the remains before staining. Researchers have said the skull is pathologically thicker than normal and may have been chosen for the hoax precisely for that reason. Modern radiocarbon dating puts the estimated age of the skull fragments at about 1,000 years. That's twice the 500 years that Oakley's fluorine analysis suggested, but nowhere near old enough to contribute to our understanding of human evolution. Now, since we've been talking about famous dead Britons, whether real or not, let's continue that theme with the story of British Cabinet Prime Minister John Stonehouse. During a business trip to Florida's Miami Beach on November 20, 1974, Stonehouse told companions he was going for a swim. When he didn't return to the hotel, investigators found a pile of his clothing on a nearby beach. Apparently, Stonehouse had either drowned or maybe was attacked by a shark. Stonehouse, who was 49 at the time of his disappearance, had held several political posts for his country, including aviation minister in the 60s and the UK's 100th postmaster general. At one time, he had been projected to be a future Labour Party leader and had aspirations to become prime minister one day. But a string of failed business ventures in the early 1970s had tarnished Stonehouse's once bright political future. His ventures had been called a money-go-round, where he would pass unsecured fraudulent loans from one of his companies to another. By the time of his disappearance, bankruptcy was looming. Stonehouse had been married for over 25 years to his wife, Barbara, and the couple had three children. The parliament member's obituary was released the same month as his disappearance, despite never finding his body. Some of Stonehouse's friends and allies suspected that organized crime mobsters or opposing political factions might have killed him. Back in the 1960s, allegations had been made that Stonehouse was a spy for the Czech government and may have been associated with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. The UK's Military Intelligence Section 5 had investigated those charges in 1969 after a Czech defector informed on Stonehouse, but MI5 ultimately decided the spying allegations were false. A month after his disappearance, on December 24th, Australian police found Stonehouse living in a Melbourne resort community. He had entered the country from Hawaii 1 week after disappearing, using a forged passport in the name of J.D. Norman. Once in Australia, Stonehouse was calling himself Clive Mildoon and opening bank accounts, but he'd also created accounts in the name of Joseph Markham. Further investigation into his movements showed Stonehouse as having left Australia the day after he first arrived there, traveling to Lebanon, Singapore, and Denmark, where he stayed with his 28-year-old secretary, Sheila Buckley, for a while, before coming back to Australia alone on December 10th. Australian police had been watching him, sitting in restaurants, reading British newspapers, but not because they thought the man was John Stonehouse. It was because they suspected he was Richard Bingham. Now, Bingham, otherwise known as Lord Lucan, was a professional gambler, once considered for the role of James Bond. Lucan had disappeared from England a month prior after his children's nanny was found bludgeoned to death in his estranged wife's basement. When they apprehended Stonehouse, investigators asked him to pull down his pants, since murder suspect Bingham had a 6-inch scar on his right thigh. The man wasn't Bingham, so who was he? Well, prior to his disappearance, Stonehouse had obtained passports and credit cards in several names and a birth certificate for Clive Mildoon. With those, he had opened Australian and Swiss bank accounts using overdraft loans from his UK banks. With that knowledge, Australia deported Stonehouse to face British authorities. While out on bail, he had the nerve to return to his seat in Parliament, even though it had already been turned over to somebody else. Apparently, Stonehouse's Disappearing Act was intended to create a new life for himself and his secretary, Sheila Buckley, or at least that's what he told her. Stonehouse claimed he had suffered a mental breakdown that he called psychiatric suicide, and his alternate names were akin to multiple personalities. Turns out his aliases were the names of some of Stonehouse's dead constituents. Less than a year before disappearing, Stonehouse had called local hospitals to gather names of men around his age who had recently died. He then visited the men's widows under a ruse to find out whether they held passports at the time of their deaths. At his trial, the prosecution claimed it was moral rather than mental breakdown that was behind Stonehouse's actions. After serving as his own attorney in the summer of 1976, Stonehouse was sentenced to prison for 7 years on various counts, including fraud, deception, and theft. His secretary got 2 years in prison, but that was suspended. After serving about half his sentence, Stonehouse was set free, having suffered 3 heart attacks during his many years in prison and undergoing heart surgery. He and Buckley married in 1981, and the couple had a son. Stonehouse began writing, including spy thrillers, which Buckley typed for him. But in 1988, Stonehouse died of his final heart attack at age 62. In 2010, the British National Archives declassified papers confirming Stonehouse had, in fact, served as a paid spy for the Czech government, making him the only UK politician to be proven a spy while a Minister of Parliament. Records showed that in 1980, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher herself agreed to keep the knowledge confidential and not prosecute Stonehouse, who was just getting out of jail at the time. Even MI5 thought nothing would be gained from going after him. Returning to the notion of copycats, 2 years after Stonehouse's disappearance, the UK television program The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin was released. It's a sitcom about a guy who starts a new life after leaving his clothes on a beach. One final note, suspected killer Lord Lucan, the man Interpol thought Stonehouse was when they tracked him to Australia, he's never been found.